Welcome to the 1CA podcast. This is your host, Jack Gaines. 1CA is a product of the Civil Affairs Association and brings in people who are current or former military, diplomats, development officers, and field agents to discuss their experiences on ground with the partner nation's people and leadership. Our goal is to inspire anyone interested in working the last 3 feet of foreign relations. To contact the show, email us at capodcasting@gmail.com or look us up on the Civil Affairs Association website at www.civilaffairsassoc.org. I'll have those in the show notes.
Welcome to One Civil Affairs Podcast. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Brian Hancock, and I will be your host for this session. Today, we're going to explore the concepts of military campaigning, civil harm mitigation, and how to align just war with postmodern conflict. To get after this, I have with me Major J. David Thompson. It just seems to me that the U.S. military, particularly civil affairs, should be far more active in Africa.
Okay. I appreciate you highlighting how Africa is important and continues to become more important. Specific to the U.S. and China, so the U.S. seeks the constructive, results-oriented relationship with China, in the Republic of China, that respects the sovereignty of all nations, rule of law, international law, and fair economic trade measures. So we welcome PRC's cooperation on issues such as climate change, global health security, arms control, non-proliferation, all issues that threaten the entire world, and we can't and want to do this. We are asking African states to choose between the U.S. and China. African countries are sovereign countries, and it's their decision. Sometimes we may have a better offer, and they may choose us, but we're not asking them to choose. Forcing various forces in Africa, so they are doing a lot of great work. And they keep getting better. It's a testament to the professionalization of the force and their integration with components and country teams. So, civil affairs forces constitute about 2% of rotational forces on Africa, and they use maybe 1% of the budget, but they execute 39.5% of all of Africa's OAIs. So, that is a higher control investment. But civil affairs, again, we don't exist in a vacuum. So we're a tool to help Africa achieve this objective, but as we work with other tools. So these tools can be security cooperation programs, other special operations forces, country teams. General Langley, the Africa combat commander, recently saying Africa gets dolls when our interagency colleagues, state and USA, specifically in this discussion we're having, are on the field, and we, being DOD, are on the bench. And that he reiterated such comments in his Senate and House testimony, Senator Armstrong's committee, House Armstrong's committee. And repeatedly brought up the whole government approach he had to his foreign policy advisor and the senior development advisor sitting right behind him. And it is a testament to the whole government approach that we seek to do at AFRICOM and how we do business. Part of that is the Global Fragility Act, or the Strategy to Prevent Conflict and Promote Stability, SPCPS. Part of GFA, or SPCPS, is that we get out of the old way of doing business. We take a long-term approach, and we think about how we can best work together with our interagency colleagues. I think we had a lot of significant growth here, and I think we've had a lot of positive benefits. So instead of thinking about civil affairs, again, as a standalone, GFA has to think about how we collaborate. And for civil affairs, I think we do this pretty well. I think we're always predispositioned to thinking about other tools of government power, even in countries that are not GFA.
I appreciate how you frame that. It seems like in the military, we sometimes have a tendency to think in zero-sum or binary terms. You know, we're at war, we're not at war, we're this country's partner or we're not. I think reality is more complicated than that. You know, for instance, with China, Dr. Brodigan, in her book, The Gift of the Dragon, talks a lot about how pieces of the One Belt, One Road initiative came to be, in that the traditional international community and IMF typically does not like to loan money for large infrastructure projects, but China was willing to. So they found a niche and they stepped into that. But we have some capabilities to offer too. And just one example, China is a very traditional patriarchal society. So for them to have an aggressive women, peace, and security program, for instance, would be very difficult for them to offer that. You know, whereas we're in a good position to do something like that. You know, my read of the National Defense Strategy is that it is kind of all about Africa. I'm not sure our resources have followed that, but I imagine that we'll be talking a lot more about Africa in the future. Now, let's turn to your 2021 publication in Volume 13, Issue 2 of Liaison. One of the focuses in that article is civilian harm mitigation. Given the recent creation of the Department of Defense Civil Protection Center, which actually published its first civil harm mitigation response plan in 2023, do you think that civil affairs may be losing some of its traditional core mission set as established by our famous progenitor, General Winfried Scott?
I had a great opportunity just recently. I got to meet with Director of the Civilian Protection Center of Excellence, Blake, and some members of his team. He has assembled an all-star team, and I think they're going to do some fascinating work. And they really love what we had to offer. They wanted us to work together. So, you know, the establishment of the CPCOE, the Civilian Protection Center of Excellence, is what it is. So I'm not saying we're losing ground. I think DOD and Army have given us guidance, and as professionals, it's up to us to do our best. We could approach it kicking and screaming, but we will likely lose opportunities. I think if we just do our best and help us succeed, we're going to realize possibilities. And I think that's what's within our control. It's how we approach it. It's one of the things I appreciate about this show. So there's an opportunity for this to be a growth industry for us. So as you know, there's not an MOS, our military occupational specialties, any non-Army listeners that strictly focuses on site harm mitigation.
You know, in civil affairs, we're trying to get civilians out of harm's way. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you see these roles as complementary, right? And they've got additional resources. And, you know, if we work together, we can potentially save more civilians caught in the line of fire.
Yeah, that's the key piece of it. It's also important for us, this understanding all of the ways civilians are harmed by military operation. So we're not talking just air civilian casualties. We're looking at damage that civilians could be harmed and developing more of a comprehensive understanding through that, looking for ways to mitigate or respond to it. In the paper with Liaison, I highlighted 5 military justifications for site harm mitigation. So I say it's our long-term force protection, and as well as our tactical victories and become strategic successes. It doesn't ask us to do any more than what we're already doing. It just asks us to get hurt. It allows partners to engage in multinational efforts, and then the positive effects on the information. A paper I just had accepted in Conflict Research Society that I'll present in September, I do address some of the shortcomings in my argument, and namely in how I approach it. So if you think oral philosophy, Kant says humans should always be the end and never the main second world period.
Same way, yeah.
So the harm mitigation, as I looked at the military justifications for it, or using the protection of civilians to help achieve the military end. So I would say my argument is not without its flaws. It does, and the moral philosophy approach, it does have some shortcomings, but ultimately civilians are being protected, and I think that's overall a good thing.
Yeah, I think we need to do even more of that. Having the moral high ground, I think, is very important in conflict, and I think how the civilian population is treated and perceives conflict has very direct impacts on whether we achieve those strategic objectives going forward, making that sacrifice of blood and treasure worthwhile. And I think there's a little bit of a shortcoming in our traditional targeting methodologies where to put a round on a target, we do a collateral damage estimate, but that estimate focuses just on the first order effects, right? Not what's going to happen in the second and third order, which are potentially significantly much greater than the initial fire's mission. So I suspect that's going to be a growth industry for us and for civil affairs for some time.
Yeah, the civilian situation is going to be interested in giving your perspectives on that and understanding how they can do it better. Specifically to Africa, I always say protecting civilians remains a vital part of our command's operations.
I want to return to your article in Liaison. You referenced Army Doctrinal Publication 3.0, and specifically, you said that understanding the human context that enables the enemy's will, which includes culture, economics, and history, not just their hard power kinetic capability, is as important as understanding the enemy's military capabilities. Now, that reads very well, probably politically very palatable to decision makers. But let me ask, in your experience, does the U.S. military actually do this, put equal emphasis on those soft power factors? For instance, when is the last time that you saw an actual civil common operating picture on the command post computing environment or the tactical mission data platform? And how often do combat arms units resource civil analysis to the extent that they resource the S2G2 and military analysis? It seems to me that in most circumstances, there's actually relatively little analysis and certainly not understanding, which is up the information value chain, of the human context in which the conflict's occurring. I've seen frequently staffs produce PEMISI, A-scope crosswalk, during the military decision planning process, and that's it. And then it kind of goes away, doesn't get briefed, and then we end up with a lot of tactical kinetic victories, but potential friction in the civil space.
My last deployment was with the Special Forces, and they had outstanding leadership. Colonel Giles and the Sergeant Major Zito, fantastic sort of everybody from the ODAs all the way up to the sort of leadership, totally on board, collaborating, and were very interested in the civil picture. Because the ODAs were focused very heavily on the friendly forces, then you had the S2s who were focused very heavily on the enemy forces. And we provided that context to the intelligence and the context to the family situation. In civil affairs, and we have civil knowledge integration. If we standalone systems or standalone reporting, they're going to, by definition, stand alone. So the way we enforce decision makers in the military is through information intelligence reports, or IIRs, and the diplomatic side is through cables. But if we integrate our civil knowledge through the cables or the IIRs and the serialized traffic, it helps to inform decision makers, and then we're not standalone. We are fully integrated into the systems that are already established to help inform people who are making those decisions. As a captain in Afghanistan, it's one of my first software rotation, but I had this great detailed work mentoring me in this process. I had a very little exploration this previously, saying, like, well, the president's not going to reach us. But what he will be, or the people who are talking to him will be, are these IARs. So I started using the IAR process in the civil affairs, and again, to clarify with the black intelligence, you're just gathering information. But we can pass that information off to people who can write IIRs or cables or whatever, and they can go forth and help inform whoever, right? And I like to focus on the integration aspects of that. And then again, if you want to talk with the Civilian Protection Center of Excellence or the goals from civilian harm mitigation or response, understanding the civilian blaming is one of the key requirements of that. So I think there's a lot to be done or civil affairs forces here.
I think you hit the nail on the head on using the IIR process. While this is information rather than intelligence, we have to admit the intelligence community with ISAM M3 and many other enterprise architecture systems have high-level visibility to senior decision makers, and trying to get civil information in front of the right people, essential for our value add to the larger military operation. I think that's a fantastic way to get about it. I'm not sure if the complexity of the civil environment easily lends itself to the kind of tactical cops that you see in our online systems. You know, we're not just moving units over geography. You know, we're doing very complicated analysis, but that's definitely a great way to add value to the systems. Appreciate you sharing that. Let's talk a little bit about, you've done actually quite a bit of work on just war, and you did publish an article titled Renegotiating Just War Tradition in Irregular Warfare. As a qualified attorney, I suspect this topic is near and dear to your heart. Let's start with what constitutes warfare. I think this gets back to that discussion we had earlier, what constitutes victory, what constitutes competition. I think warfare now, in modern terms, be in the same category. Does warfare, for instance, have to be kinetic to be war? Is there such a thing as economic or political or legal warfare? And if those things do exist, how would we apply the just war tradition to all of those things?
Thanks. So that paper hasn't been published yet. It's hopefully coming out here soon. But yes, be on the lookout. I will be sure to flag it to the Soul Earth community when it is done. So JP1, Volume 1, identifies two types of warfare, conventional and reactionary. And this is layers we've been working away dissertation about, so I'm going to try not to go too in-depth here, because that would be a series of podcast discussions as opposed to a 45-minute discussion on a series of topics. So I think just more tradition, or also called just more fury, reach on providing a framework to analyze the ethics of conventional warfare. And there are multiple ways to approach just war tradition. I'm not going to get into these because that is probably more apt for a philosophical community focused on just war that most listeners probably don't share. But if anybody does, reach out to me. Happy to have that chat. So just war tradition, of all of its approaches, gives a great framework and vocabulary to discuss conventional warfare. You said about them. We're writing to war, use symbolic, write conduct in war, use postbellum, maybe more justly. We can think about that very clearly in conventional war. It does a less good job in irregular warfare, and particularly what I'm looking at is proxy warfare. So what I'm trying to do is build that framework and build that vocabulary to allow people making decisions that don't go to war, people conducting wars, and then also ending proxy wars justly. So because it doesn't necessarily provide a great framework, it doesn't mean we need to just bang bang it all with the backboard. Just war tradition is that we're evolving, and this renegotiation of just war tradition to give the framework and vocabulary on the ethics of irregular warfare, proxy warfare, is not a far stretch. Now, some people may not accept this argument that just war shouldn't have evolving notions of as relevant. I will say that the definitions of irregular warfare undergo numerous changes. The 2018 and 2024 National Defense Authorization Act had different definitions for irregular warfare. Department of Defense recently changed this definition of irregular warfare. The Joint Chiefs of Staff recently changed their definition of irregular warfare. And that to be undone, or being created its own definition.
Wow.
All these definitions, I would not say that irregular warfare is irrelevant. So I don't think this is a far stretch here. One of the potential weaknesses of my argument is that some people say that irregular warfare is a warfare at all. Now, the joint publication disagrees with you. And even if that is your position, okay, so what? We're still left without this ethical framework to think about it. So just for tradition, again, you said all the right to war, looking at all the criteria in it, just authority, just cause, or tribality, necessity, the independent exhaust of peaceful alternatives, right intention, and reasonable chance of success, use of dull, proportionality, discrimination, and then use postbellum, ending words just. Rights and responsibilities owed to each party. Thinking about irregular warfare, measures short of conventional warfare. Dr. Daniel West of King's College London has a great paper called All We Fight Yet. It's open access, and I can't recommend it enough.
Actually, I'm familiar with that paper. It's fantastic and raises a lot of important questions that we need to answer. For the audience, I suspect we can't dismiss irregular warfare. Our partners in the ground combat element, the Marine Corps, they've actually just moved to make irregular warfare a core competency of their entire force. So this problem is not going away. In fact, I suspect it's going to get worse as more and more nations get access to weapons of mass destruction and more non-state actors continue to rise. Now, I doubt the listeners are surprised that our traditional definitions of just war, you know, defined by that tradition, have not kept pace with the frameworks imposed by modern gray zone operations exercised not only by nation states with whole of government efforts, but also these non-state actors with their own individual agendas. And this harkens back to our previous discussion of the difficulty of defining terms like competition. But I think we need to talk about that because we're going to be in competition 99% of the time. Now, I don't think 99% of our resources are designed to making us win without fighting in competition. But given that reality and the importance of it, And we just published at the joint level, the joint concept for competing in February 10, 2023. That document leaves out a number of the most important questions that they're still not answered, especially as we start getting into some of the ethical implications of what we're looking at here. Now, based on your research, though, where you'll be writing your dissertation at some point, how does just war tradition apply to military operations in competition, specifically to include special forces activities?
Again, if we're talking competition, I have to ask, are we using it to strengthen or to restrict it? And as it's a little very familiar, and I would have questions on if I'm talking descriptively, like who, what, why, very basic level questions. If we're using it as prescribing activities under competition, then I think we're a tad bit better. And I think we can analyze who is acting these, what are the causes and furtherance of, is the competition proportionate? Has it exhausted peaceful alternatives? Is it in line with the exhausted alternatives? And do these prescribed activities have a reasonable chance of success? If we're using it prescriptively, I think just war provides a pretty good framework for thinking about it. But if we're using it descriptively, then I think we have to kind of go back and ask some more fundamental questions. This does highlight the ambiguity, and some of this I've pointed out before, is that states take advantage of ambiguity to shift risk, so it's tactical, strategic, and political, as to what actors count and what makes them count. Looking at these risks, you could say, like, what rules apply? Who do they apply to?
Let me ask one final question about just war tradition. Now, the DoD Law of War Manual, I'm not an expert on this, but taking a quick look at it and how they define a party to a conflict, let's take a look at our role in Ukraine, certainly as a stakeholder, and probably more than that. Does our level of involvement in Ukraine, in your opinion, rise to the level of us potentially being considered a party to that conflict?
Now, what's the DoD law on what international law more broadly? Just because one violates the law of neutrality does not necessarily mean that the person has become a belligerent to the conflict. So there is a gap between violating law of neutrality and then before you become a belligerent to the conflict. So that I do find interestingly enough, what the DoD law or manual does have is it does involve a bit of thinking about the just war tradition. Chapter 1 looks at the use of bellum, Chapter 2 a little bit more of the use of bellum. It follows the orthodox approach that was popularized by Mike Walzer. But interestingly enough, it doesn't include chance of success as one of the use at bellum criteria. So I do find that interesting. But I think when we're talking about how states take advantage of ambiguity, let's go back to what I was just saying a second ago about violating neutrality to when I think violating neutrality is not so ambiguous. Become a belligerent to a conflict, it was a little bit more ambiguous. So I do think states take advantage in that.
All right. Sounds like we have more work to do in that area so that we have a working definition. You know, obviously, Russia is going to attempt to portray not only the United States, but NATO and others as direct parties to that conflict, you know, if nothing else for face saving, given the losses they've experienced without actually having to fight NATO forces. So that one's not going away, and we'll probably revisit it. We're approaching our time here. Let me give you the floor one last time. Is there anything else you'd like to say to our community?
First, thank you, Sarah, for hosting the discussion, and thank you to the Civil Affairs Association, the 1CA podcast, for continuing the professional education and development of Civil Affairs Forces, and I look forward to doing it again sometime.
Thanks, Dave. This is very stimulating for me. I was really looking forward to your interview here. Appreciate you sharing the gift of your time with us today.
You take care.
All right, out here.
Thanks for listening. If you get a chance, please like and subscribe and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. Also, if you're interested in coming on the show or hosting an episode, email us at capodcasting@gmail.com. I'll have the email and CA Association website in the show notes. And now, most importantly, to those currently out in the field, working with a partner nation's people or leadership to forward U.S. relations, thank you all for what you're doing. This is Jack, your host. Stay tuned for more great episodes, 1CA Podcast.